So, the world's most critical oil choke point just closed.
Right, which is terrifying.
Yeah. 20% of the global seaborne oil supply just, well, vanished almost overnight. And the price of Brent crude spiked to $126 a barrel.
Just massive number.
Exactly. I mean, by every traditional metric of global economics, we should be looking at a synchronized, catastrophic global depression right now.
Absolutely.
And yet, in the middle of what is objectively the worst energy supply disruption in history, the OECD just released their updated forecasts and they upgraded US GDP growth
Yeah, upgraded it.
while simultaneously, severely downgrading Europe and Asia. So today, we are looking at how that is even mathematically possible.
It is a divergence that has capitals from Berlin to Tokyo in a state of absolute panic. We're looking at a scenario where the biggest macroeconomic boulder imaginable just dropped into the pond. But instead of swamping every boat, the U.S. economy is essentially, out there surfing the tidal wave.
Right. Which brings us to the mission of today's deep dive. We are unpacking a dense, frankly mind-bending analytical document for you titled America's Oil Shock Paradox: Why the U.S. Wins While the World Burns.
It's a heavy read.
It really is. We're mapping the severe, highly asymmetric economic impact of the March 2026 Strait of Hormuz closure, following Operation Epic Fury.
Right.
Now, before we jump in, because the source material we are exploring deals with highly charged, ongoing military and political actions involving the current U.S. administration, the Iranian government, and, well, intense diplomatic fractures with international allies, I want to set the ground rules for you right now.
Very important.
Yeah, our focus today is entirely on mapping out the raw economic and geopolitical data. We aren't here to litigate the politics, we aren't endorsing any figures, and we certainly aren't validating the left-wing or right-wing ideological viewpoints found in these documents. Our goal is strictly to impartially analyze the mechanics of this crisis.
Yeah, that distinction is vital. We are tearing down the engine of this global crisis to see how the gears are turning, right?
Yeah.
Not debating who should be driving the car.
Exactly.
And to really understand the mechanics of how the United States is basically shrugging off $126 oil, we have to contrast it with the last time something remotely similar happened.
You mean the 1973 Arab oil embargo?
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because in 1973, an oil shock meant, gas lines around the block, crippling inflation, and a brutal recession.
It shattered the American economy.
Right, like a rigid glass frame that just shattered under pressure. Today, it's more like a shock absorber. So, how does a nation go from being that fragile to actually catching a GDP upgrade during an arguably worse disruption in 2026?
Well, the underlying architecture of the U.S. economy underwent a 40-year structural revolution. I mean, in 1973, the U.S. was fundamentally dependent on OPEC, relying on them for 70% of its petroleum imports.
Wow, 70%.
Yeah. But fast forward to today, and the U.S. is a net exporter. It produces 13.5 million barrels per day domestically. It runs a $58 billion petroleum trade surplus, and it imports a mere 7% of its crude from the Persian Gulf.
So the Middle East is barely a factor for them physically.
Right. The vast majority of its imported oil, about 56%, actually comes from right across the border in Canada. But, the geographic source of the oil is really only half the equation. The real insulation comes from how the economy actually functions today.
So you're talking about the transition to a service-based economy.
Exactly. The U.S. economy is now roughly 78 to 80% services. Back in 1973, manufacturing was about 25% of the GDP.
Right, heavy industry.
Yeah. If you were building an economy around app developers, healthcare logistics, and financial analysts, your energy input requirement is vastly lower than an economy built around steel mills and auto manufacturing.
Makes total sense.
The data shows U.S. oil intensity, meaning the physical amount of oil required to generate one single dollar of GDP, has plummeted by 70% over the last four decades. So the U.S. economy has tripled in size since the late 70s, but it consumes roughly the same absolute volume of oil.
Wow.
Contrast that with Germany, where heavy manufacturing still makes up 20% of their GDP. They are acutely, painfully sensitive to the cost of energy inputs.
Yeah, I follow the logic on the macro level, but I want to push back a bit on this idea of total insulation.
Okay.
Because the Dallas Fed modeled this exact scenario, right? And they pointed out that a one-quarter disruption does shave 0.2 points off U.S. GDP. I mean, high gas prices still physically hurt the American consumer paying at the pump. What specific mechanism is offsetting that localized domestic pain so aggressively that the aggregate national outlook actually improves?
So the primary mechanism is what economists call the internal recycling mechanism.
Okay, what is that?
Well, In 1973, when oil prices spiked, American dollars hemorrhaged out of the country to the Middle East. It was a staggering transfer of national wealth. Today, when oil hits $126, those windfall profits are captured by domestic entities.
I see.
Yeah, ExxonMobil, for instance, is projecting an incremental $4.5 billion in net profit just for the first quarter of this crisis.
Wow. So to use an analogy, it's like a casino where the house keeps all the lost bets rather than the money leaving town. The wealth stays inside the borders.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. That capital circulates directly back into the U.S. economy. You see it in higher wages for domestic energy workers in the Permian Basin, massive dividend payouts that land the 401ks of American shareholders, increased federal and state tax revenues.
Right. It all stays home.
Exactly. Plus huge capital expenditure back into U.S. infrastructure.
Mm.
BNP Paribas calculates that higher oil prices now redistribute income within the U.S. rather than draining it abroad.
Fascinating.
But that recycling mechanism isn't acting alone. You also have the historic 172 million barrel drawdown from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve actively flooding the domestic market to blunt the immediate consumer impact.
Right.
And crucially, there is a massive macroeconomic counterweight happening in the tech sector.
Oh, you mean the artificial intelligence boom?
Yes. The U.S. is currently riding a $650 billion capital expenditure cycle driven entirely by AI and hyperscaler data centers.
$650 billion. That's insane.
It represents about 2% of the entire GDP. And these tech companies aren't heavily constrained by the cost of transport fuel. Their bottleneck is compute power and domestic electricity, which is largely powered by natural gas and renewables.
So they just keep spending.
Right. They continue pouring hundreds of billions into infrastructure, acting as a massive growth tailwind that mathematically fights off the energy-driven demand destruction in the consumer sector.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, because oil is only half the equation here. The U.S. isn't just surviving the oil shock. It is actively stepping into a massive market void created by the physical destruction of Middle Eastern infrastructure. And this brings us to the liquid natural gas, or LNG, side of the crisis.
Yeah, this is where the divergence between the U.S. and its allies becomes incredibly stark.
Right.
Because in early March, Iranian drone strikes devastated Qatar's Ras Laffan complex. And that is the largest gas export facility on the planet.
Mm.
The strikes wiped out an estimated 17% of Qatar's export capacity in a matter of hours.
17% just gone.
We're talking about 80 million tons of LNG violently removed from the global market. And Qatar Energy admits it will take 3 to 5 years to repair that infrastructure.
Which means the pre-war global gas glut is just, well, it's gone.
Completely gone.
And we saw the Asian benchmark price, the JKM, double to $25.40. The European benchmark surged 63%. But the U.S. domestic benchmark for natural gas, the Henry Hub price, barely budged.
Right.
It only rose 7% to $3.20. The spread between what gas costs in the U.S. and what desperate buyers in Asia are forced to pay blew out to nearly $16 per million BTU. I mean, that is a staggering arbitrage opportunity.
What's fascinating here is that we are watching the physical rewiring of the global energy supply chain in real time. That arbitrage spread you mentioned is literally causing massive cargo ships to divert mid-ocean.
Wait, really?
Yes. The sources highlight a specific vessel, the UMM Guilina, which loaded LNG in Louisiana destined for Belgium. Because of the price spike in Asia, it rerouted mid-journey to China. Wood Mackenzie projects that Asian buyers now have to replace up to 90% of their exposure to Qatar and the UAE.
And the United States is basically the only player on the board with the capacity to fill that void.
Exactly.
Which explains why Cheniere Energy's stock surged 52% on record revenues. And at the Indo-Pacific Energy Ministerial in Tokyo, we saw 22 agreements worth $57 billion signed.
Huge numbers.
Yeah. The U.S. LNG export capacity is already set to nearly double by 2031, and now projects in Texas and Louisiana are locking in 20-year contracts with South Korea, Taiwan, and even Saudi Aramco. So are we basically watching the U.S. use this crisis to lock the world into an American energy monopoly for the next few decades?
I mean, the data certainly points to an unprecedented consolidation of market share. By removing the primary Middle Eastern competitor for half a decade, the U.S. energy sector secures long-term dominance. But the cost to America's traditional allies is agonizing.
So what does this all mean for the listener trying to map this out globally? It's as if the U.S. is safely standing on dry land, selling lifeboats at a premium to allies who are actively drowning.
Yeah.
Because the economic pain in Europe and Asia is brutal right now.
It is severe. I mean, Europe is facing a technical recession. When the strait closed, European gas storage was sitting at a dire 28% to 30%.
Yeah.
Now you have chemical and steel manufacturers in Germany slapping 30% surcharges on everything just to keep the lights on. In Asia, the impact is even more immediate. South Korea's KOSPI index plunged 12% in a single day.
12%.
The largest drop in its history, because manufacturing giants like Samsung are deeply exposed to imported energy costs. The Philippines actually declared a national energy emergency because they had less than 10 days of diesel reserves left.
And while the civilian economies of these allies are choking, the U.S. defense sector is experiencing a boom that makes the early Iraq war look incredibly slow.
The operational tempo is staggering. In just the first few weeks, U.S. forces fired 850 Tomahawk cruise missiles, striking over 11,000 targets. The Pentagon stated this depleted years' worth of stockpiles.
Years' worth? Just gone in weeks.
Yeah. So to replenish and expand, the Pentagon requested a $200 billion supplemental budget. They are forcing defense contractors to quadruple production of advanced weaponry, even barring them from stock buybacks until they hit those manufacturing targets.
I understand the military necessity, but let's connect the macro math here. How does a $200 billion payout to defense contractors offset the pain of an Ohio family paying more for groceries and gas?
Because that $200 billion is a massive fiscal stimulus injected directly into the U.S. industrial base. It forces the hiring of thousands of engineers, machinists, and logistics personnel. It requires purchasing domestic steel and electronics.
Oh, I see.
It props up aggregate demand across the entire domestic supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
So while the distributional effects are uneven, meaning the defense contractor benefits more than the family in Ohio, the sheer volume of that spending keeps the national GDP growth numbers in the green.
But those defense contractors aren't just selling to the Pentagon. War risk insurance premiums for commercial shipping in the Middle East have surged from 0.15% of a ship's hull value to an insane 10%.
Which is essentially an embargo.
Right. It kills commercial shipping without even needing a physical blockade. So allies are totally cut off from their energy lifelines while simultaneously being fast-tracked to buy billions in American weapons to defend whatever shipping lanes they have left. How are America's allies reacting to being left out in the cold while U.S. defense contractors rake in billions?
Their reaction is explosive.
Yeah.
And it leads to perhaps the most controversial geopolitical shift detailed in these sources.
Yeah.
This crisis marks the definitive end of the Carter Doctrine.
Wait, the 1980 policy.
Exactly.
The one that essentially committed the U.S. military to ensuring the free flow of oil out of the Persian Gulf.
Correct. For 46 years, every U.S. president treated free passage through the Strait of Hormuz as a core non-negotiable American security guarantee. The U.S. Navy protected the global energy commons.
But not anymore.
No. Because of the structural revolution we discussed, because the U.S. is now energy independent, it no longer bears the economic risk of a closure. And the current administration has explicitly told European and Asian allies who are begging for naval escorts to go to the Strait and just take IT.
Wow.
They told them to learn to fight for themselves. The White House actually stated that reopening the strait for commercial transit is not one of the core objectives of the ongoing military operation.
But the rhetoric coming out of Washington is wildly incoherent. I mean, one day they threaten to obliterate Iran's power plants within 48 hours. The next day they pivot, say the strait isn't a core objective, and completely disengage.
Yeah, it's whiplash.
And then a few days after that, they issue a brand new ultimatum threatening to rain all hell on Iran. Is this erratic oscillation just terrible communication, or is the U.S. intentionally weaponizing its energy independence to force allies into line, essentially punishing them with a recession?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the diplomatic fallout strongly suggests the allies believe they're being extorted. The feeling of abandonment is profound.
I can imagine.
German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius was furious in his public remarks. He asked what exactly the U.S. expects a handful of European frigates to achieve if the U.S. Navy refuses to clear the waterway. He stated flatly, "This is not our war." And the fracture is so deep that the U.K. actually convened a 40-nation virtual summit to plan a strategy for reopening the strait, and they pointedly excluded both the United States and Israel from the planning.
A 40-nation summit deliberately bypassing the primary guarantor of global security.
Yeah.
That is a massive paradigm shift.
It is. And geopolitics abhors a vacuum. By stepping back from its historical role, the U.S. is allowing China to step right in.
Of course.
China relies heavily on Middle Eastern oil, but they are currently insulated by massive domestic coal reserves, pipeline supply from Russia, and a massive strategic reserve. Because they aren't engaged in the military strikes, they are now offering to mediate the conflict.
So they play the peacemaker.
Exactly. Chinese-flagged vessels are among the very few still transiting the strait safely, and they're reportedly paying transit fees directly to the Iranians in Chinese yuan. It's a seismic shift in global influence.
Up to this point in the data, it sounds like the U.S. holds all the cards. They have the energy, they're dominating the defense market, and they're mathematically insulated while everyone else suffers. But the sources reveal some severe hidden vulnerabilities.
Yes, they do.
This dangerous advantage the U.S. is exploiting has massive blind spots that are beginning to boomerang back onto the American consumer, doesn't it?
The assumption of total U.S. immunity is a very dangerous complacency. You should look at the financial markets to see the cracks. Normally, in a global geopolitical crisis of this magnitude, investors panic and flood into U.S. Treasury bonds as the ultimate safe haven.
Right, flight to safety.
But after this conflict ignited, Treasury bonds aggressively sold off. Yields hit 4.46%.
Wait, if the U.S. is essentially winning the economic side of this war, why are its bonds selling off?
Because the mechanism of bond valuation is entirely dependent on inflation expectations. Fixed income assets like Treasury bonds offer absolutely no shelter when inflation erodes the value of the currency. The market is looking at a $200 billion war supplemental budget layered on top of an already massive federal deficit.
Plus the structural supply chain disruptions.
Right. They aren't pricing in a deflationary recession. They are terrified of a massive inflationary spike. So they are repressing the risk of holding U.S. debt.
It's like thinking you're completely safe from a neighborhood fire because your own house is fireproof, but forgetting you still need to buy groceries from the store down the street that just burned down.
This brings us to perhaps the most critical boomerang effect in the entire document, the fertilizer market.
Oh, wow.
You cannot isolate a modern economy from global agricultural inputs. Nearly 30% of all internationally traded fertilizers transit to the Strait of Hormuz.
30%? That is a catastrophic bottleneck.
Yeah, and it's driven by natural gas. Natural gas is the primary feedstock for creating ammonia, which is then used to create urea. Because Qatar and other Gulf states are massive producers of these chemicals, the disruption immediately spiked granular urea prices by 50%, hitting $700 a metric ton.
That's huge.
Ammonia surged 20%. And the timing couldn't be worse. This disruption hit right during the Northern Hemisphere spring planting season. So this is no longer just an energy crisis. It is the catalyst for a synchronized global food production crisis that will severely compound into the 2026 harvest and dictate grocery prices well into 2027.
And you can't just drill more oil in the Permian Basin to magically fix a chemical fertilizer shortage in the global supply chain.
Exactly.
The Dallas Fed noted that a prolonged three-quarter closure of the strait will ultimately shave 1.3 points off U.S. GDP. If inflation hits 3.4% because of these food and supply chain shocks, is America's complacency going to trap it in a stagflation cycle anyway, despite all this domestic energy production?
This raises an important question about the long-term cost of short-term opportunism. Under the most severe scenarios modeled by Oxford Economics, where the conflict drags out and oil stays above $140 for a prolonged period, global GDP growth plummets to 1.4%.
Wow, that's grim.
That represents the worst synchronized global downturn in 40 years, excluding the 2008 financial crisis and the pandemic. In a contraction that deep, the U.S. cannot escape. It ultimately slides into a shallow recession driven by sticky inflation that steadily erodes consumer spending.
Right.
But beyond the immediate economic mathematics, the real existential danger is the precedent being set right now.
The precedent of abandoning the global commons.
Exactly. Think about the message this telegraphs to the rest of the world. If a superpower like the United States allows a vital international waterway to be shut down, simply because that disruption happens to benefit its domestic energy and defense sectors in the short term.
What stops other nations from replicating this strategy? You're talking about Beijing looking at the Taiwan Strait or the South China Sea. If they achieve self-sufficiency in microchips or critical minerals, they could blockade a global commons and simply watch their economic rivals suffocate.
The strategic logic is identical. The U.S. might win the financial metrics of this specific crisis in the short term, but by walking away from its historical role as the guarantor of global trade, it is fundamentally dismantling the international order it spent 80 years building. It is signaling that the era of shared vulnerability is over, replaced by an era of zero-sum opportunism.
That is a deeply sobering reality to pull us out of the data. Let's synthesize everything we've unpacked for you today. The March 2026 closure of the Strait of Hormuz is proving to be much more than a temporary spike in the price of energy.
It really is.
It is a permanent structural realignment of the global economy. Over the last 40 years, the United States has engineered a reality where its greatest historical vulnerability, its reliance on Middle Eastern oil, has transformed into its most potent asymmetric weapon. Through massive domestic production, a services-heavy economy, and LNG expansion, the U.S. is actively enriching its own energy and defense sectors while watching its closest allies in Europe and Asia face agonizing economic contraction.
It is a total paradigm shift. The long-term contracts being signed right now in Tokyo and Texas are locking in a reality where the era of cheap, globally guaranteed energy flows is officially over.
Right.
The U.S. is replacing the open market with an American monopoly.
Which means your new reality is going to be fundamentally more expensive, highly fragmented, and overwhelmingly reliant on American supply lines. Which brings us to our final thought. We want you to think about this as you go about your day, because it lingers long after the crude oil prices eventually settle. If the United States has just proven to the world that true independence means you can comfortably watch global supply chains burn from afar, reaping the profits while your allies drown, how will other rising superpowers behave when they finally achieve self-sufficiency in the critical resources of tomorrow?
This is a scary thought.
Are we entering an age where protecting global trade is for suckers and weaponizing disruption is the new gold standard?
It's the paradox we all have to navigate now.
Thanks for taking the deep dive with us. Catch you next time.